What about a memorable interview experience, either good or bad? But does anything come to mind when I bring that up?
I interviewed somebody who said that they had collective bargaining experience and it wasn't going great at the very end. And I don't even know if I should have said this or not, but I said, listen, there's no way in hell you're going to get this job, but I have to ask you something. Tell me about your collective bargaining experience. And the candidate said, yeah. She says, that's where you partner with other companies to get better prices on things like office supplies and things like that. And I was like, thank you very much.
Wow. So that is not what collective bargaining is. You already knew they weren't getting the job, but that had to seal the deal for you. Welcome to another episode of Higher Learning. I am your host, Oz Rashid. This is the show where we talk to executives and founders who are disrupting and changing companies and industries about what they see differently when they're identifying unique talent. If this is your first time listening, welcome to the show. We are glad to have you. If you're a longtime listener, we always appreciate the support. Everybody, please subscribe, Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts, and give us a great rating. Today, we have a very special guest. We are joined by Andrew Tidwell. He is the Chief Human Resources Officer at Wine Shipping. Andrew, how you doing, bud?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Oz.
Here down here in beautiful South Florida, are you enjoying this 65 degree weather?
No.
No? You want it to be hot?
I'm wearing warmer.
Wow. I know there's somebody listening to this in New York right now or up in Chicago, and they're like, this guy's crazy. You like it warm, huh?
I'm acclimated, as they say.
I love that. Yeah, I've got my blood is so thin now. I get into anything below 70 degrees, and I wear a sweater, as you can see.
For sure.
You are the head of HR at Wine Shipping, my friend. What do they do? Sounds kind of obvious with the name, but tell us. And what drew you to the company in the first place?
So we're the premier direct-to-consumer shipper for wineries, digitally native wineries in wine-producing regions, boutique wineries. We handle it all. It's basically a logistics operation, and I've got a lot of experience in logistics, and I'm actually working with some people I know very well and trust a lot, which at this point in my career is extremely important.
Love that. Yeah. So let me kind of run through an example here. So, you know, maybe, and there's wineries all over the country, obviously, but let's say we're in Napa, you work with them, they do all the producing, I'm assuming the packaging and the bottling, and then you handle the logistics to either e-commerce or retail.
That's exactly right. You know, you go to visit Cliff Lady, for example, on the Silverado Trail in Napa, and you have a great day at a beautiful place, and they put the food out in front of you, try these great wines, and they say to you, hey, would you like to take some wine home? And you feel like a jerk if you don't, right? So you buy this wine and you don't want to carry a case of it on the airplane, so we ship it to your house. And then there's clubs. A lot of people are members of winery clubs, and they like to get regular shipments of the releases from those wineries, and we handle all of that as well. Right now, we're in the middle of our peak season, which is the busiest time of year for us. We also have a small peak in the spring too, but you know, the cooler months of the year are, you know, prime for shipping wine across the country.
Yeah. You know what? I'm going to ask you something just out of my own curiosity. I've been talking to my wife. We've been talking about going on a Napa trip for many, many years now. We do enjoy a good glass of wine. Like, what is the time of year that's best to go to a winery, in your opinion?
Oh, gosh. Any time of year is great to go to Napa. I'd
so
say
like probably, in February, that would be a good time?
It would be a great time.
All right. Now, you know what? I was thinking about a trip in February. You just helped me. And I don't know if this is a good or a bad thing, but it's 11 o'clock in the morning, Eastern Standard Time, and you're making me think about having a glass of red wine. So maybe that's just, maybe that's you. I don't know.
What's I guarantee you're not the only person who feels that
way. What have you learned about wine logistics since joining that might surprise us?
You know, it's a logistics operation. So, I mean, theoretically there could be anything in those boxes. You know, we're very data driven, very process driven. We bring, you know, kind of that outside expertise in there. And so I'd say that something that was a surprise for me was just the sheer volume of folks who buy wine, you know, that way. You know, we ship millions of packages every year, and it just doesn't seem to let up. There have been some changes from here to there. Some wineries, you know, do better. Some are getting started, but it's just I think the greatest surprise for me was some of the high-end wines that we sell. We're located right next to the Napa Executive Airport and a jet of land over there. And then, you know, here comes a big black suburban to our will call, and they'll load up 5 cases of Screaming Eagle. If you've never heard of that, Google it. Then they'll go put it on the jet, and the jet flies away, and you're like, wow.
Screaming Eagle, I'm in. This is why I listen to my own podcast. I need to get recommendations on great wine. That's awesome. Okay, I got to be honest with you, brother, and I don't want to generalize here. You do not strike me as a guy that, like, at 8 or 9 years old was thinking, I really want to get into employee relations and payroll. So can you walk me through kind of your journey into HR? Was it intentional, or was it something you fell into?
Oh, you know, just like everybody else you talk to, I lucked into it. You know, when I was a kid, we always played private equity, you know, on the playground. I worked for UPS when I was in college. It's the only part-time job that I ever worked 60 hours a week, you know? Wow. And I was good at training people. And I was good at dealing with difficult situations at an early age. And I got asked to do more of that in more difficult places. And just one thing led to another. And UPS is a great organization that trains people really well. So, you know, I've been doing this a long time. And back when there was new employment legislation coming out, you know, they trained me up on it. They trained me on the National Labor Relations Act. You know, I was in the South, you know, which is not typically a place where you experience a whole lot of, you know, organized labor, but I was like a expert in, you know, dealing with unions at that point at a real early age. So it was just something that happened. I enjoyed it, and the right folks encouraged me and just continued to develop me. I have some terrific teachers.
I love that, man. What about this? I mean, one of the big things that it sounds like, both personally for you, but then also the organizations that you're advising in your role and capacity, is the building of strong teams. And it sounds like you've built some really, really strong teams in the past. I'm interested in what you think are the qualities of a high performing team. And then what would you advise people who are looking to build, you know, the next great team?
I think a really high performing team has its own language that it understands. They're extraordinarily connected to one another. We have some principles that we follow in our relationships. The acronym for it's ISOAR, ISOAR, and I stands for interdependence, and that's our willingness to collaborate with people. S is shared purpose. If we all know where we're going, we really don't need a whole lot of supervision, because that sort of lives in here and, you know, dictates what we do. O is ownership, and that's where we get reliability. A reliable result, because honestly, you know, business is a battle of execution, not necessarily, you know, ideas. And A is for affinity. When we have high affinity and trust in our relationships, we can go really, really fast. We don't have to kind of do that, you know, dance. Am I going to bother this person? Are they going to be worried about what I'm telling them? And then R is risk taking. And risk taking can be just as simple as speaking up in a group. You know, we've all been there when they say, does anybody have any questions? And nobody has any questions. And then after the meeting's over, everybody has questions, you know? So sometimes just speaking up is a way of taking a risk at work.
Okay. Walk me through that acronym again. So what was it? What were the letters?
It's I, you mean go through the whole thing?
No. Just tell me the letters again.
ISOAR, ISOAR.
Ooh, I love acronyms. You know, my company's MSH, right?
Like, yeah. I know you do. I forget what the S stands for sometimes, but.
It's make. Good stuff, man. Okay, that's awesome. You've mentioned to me, and I listen, you know, I think about interviews a lot, kind of go to bed thinking about interviews, wake up thinking about interviews. I'm doing an interview right now. You mentioned to me that interviews can start off artificial, and that you have to actually, your job as an interviewer is to move them into being real and honest as quickly as possible. What advice do you give to do that in real time to people who are listening to this?
So I think that people have a lot of anxiety about interviews. They think, you know, here's my one shot to make my impression. And if I nail this, then I get the chance to go on to round two or whatever. And if I screw it up, I'm dead in the water. And I think putting people at ease as fast as you can, you know, telling them that I'm really happy to meet them. I'm really looking forward to hearing what they want to ask me, because they need to be making a good choice too in this process. And I like to be very transparent up front. You know, a lot of times we push those compensation, you know, discussions way until the end, after we've got weeks and weeks of, you know, contact and relationships and time invested, and only to find out that they're going to be underwhelmed with what you plan to offer. So what I like to make sure is that stuff's on the table and that we are definitely in the same neighborhood before we start riding bikes together, if you know what I mean. I like to ask people, what do they do for fun? That's remarkably, you'd be surprised how many people are not prepared to answer that question because they've really been focused on these, you know, numbers and facts and things about the position that they want to you to relate them to. So that's another
thing there though. Have you ever asked anybody that question and been turned off on the response?
Yeah. I have. You know, people will say things like, you know, I just work really hard. And you're like, come on, man, you know, or come on. There's some way you enjoy to spend your time. Other people will say, you know, yeah, it's like, you know, my weakness. I work too hard. Really?
They're setting you up with artificial answers. They're still keeping that superficial veil that you're trying to pierce through. What about like, I mean, I got to imagine this has happened. You're interviewing at Wine Shipping. I love to drink a good glass of wine. I like to drink a good bottle of wine. That's a good thing at Wine Shipping, I imagine, right?
It is a good thing as long as you do it on your own time. You know, it's really funny when people ask me, there's like, what do you do for a living? I work for this company that, you know, ships wine. Oh, really? Can you get me some wine? That's what we do. We constantly give away free wine to people who ask for it.
I mean, now I got to get rid of my third question. Okay. I got to cross that line. Jeez Louise. All right. Does not give free wine. I appreciate that, man. That's good. And I totally agree with you in that. An interview is a set up situation that many times some people will bring more tension and more intensity to it. And I just think that's such a mistake because ultimately at the end of the day, I'd like to think that you're going to, what I try to do is I try to mimic different types of environments and situations that you might see in the workplace. So to your point, I love to have some level of casual conversation where I'm digging into the person. Sure. I love to throw sometimes a curveball or two, not in a disingenuous way, but just put them on a different line of thinking right away and see how they react and respond and if they get flustered or if they can handle it. I love to have them get into the details. And like one of the questions I like to ask is, you know, tell me something that you're an expert in, right? Maybe even outside of the work world. It could be kite surfing, it could be painting, I don't know. And then explain it to me as somebody that have never experienced it. So like I'm trying to get them to articulate a complex subject or something that they're passionate about, but break it down to me at a level where I'm going to be able to more easily understand it, because that is something that happens in the workplace all the time, where you're having to break down something, whether it be training, whether it be just communicating, right? And then I always advise people, like, if you're only got one switch when it comes to like location or the way that you're interviewing, whether it's a video or a Zoom or it's a conference room on site or a phone, you're making a mistake. Like I like to like try to get people into hey, let's go to a lunch, right? Let's go to a situation that's maybe outside of the workplace. Because I think you get a different level of who that person is. And that's, again, another situation where you're seeing them outside of kind of a traditional work situation. Maybe it's just me, but I am always constantly trying to figure out, whether it's in my own interview or throughout an interview process, how do I put them in different situations that are going to give me an idea of how they will respond or how they will act in very real common office work situations, whatever it may be. What do you think about that?
No, I think you're spot on. I mean, one of the questions I like to ask people is, you know, what would you do if somebody accused you of doing something you did that wasn't your fault?
Ooh.
Yeah. That's a really good question. You get a pretty wide range of answers there. Another one, when I'm interviewing salespeople, you know, I'll have them talk to me and, you know, looking for a high performer. And when they get finished, I'll say, you know, I'm just not really hearing high performance. And what happens is if they give up, then that's probably not the right person. If they dig in and keep going, then that's a good sign that there's resilience there and that they have that, you know, attitude about success that we're looking for in that role. I also say things like, I read a long time ago in a book called Top Grading, they have this thing called, torque, the thread of reference check. And I would say, you know, okay, Oz, so when I call, you know, so-and-so who used to be your boss, what are they going to tell me that you need to do better? You know, and it's not if, it's when. And, you know, and it's kind of like, okay, they're going to triangulate this answer, so I'd better not throw a lot of BS out there. That's been pretty helpful too.
Like that. Some real good. Yeah. Actionable stuff there. All right, let's answer your question. Andrew, what do you do if somebody accuses you of doing something you didn't do?
I'd have to say, wow, I'd have to understand, why do you think that was my thing? Let's go through it together. You know, I mean, I wouldn't be defensive about it, I don't think. You know, whenever there's a breakdown at work, the best thing you can do is you can kind of bring passion to it and energy. It's about what happened. You know, 99% of the problems are process problems. They're not people problems. People don't wake up in the morning and go to work and say, gee, how can I screw things up? You know, it's a shortcut. You know, I'm tired, I'm upset, I'm busy, whatever. You know, there's a lot of stuff like that. And you can figure it out if you take the I'm not blaming you approach. I just want to figure out what happened.
I like that. And that comes up in your job every so often. And as a founder and entrepreneur and CEO, comes up in my job every so often. I like to think that if somebody accused me of something that I didn't do, my first thoughts would be around, okay, what's the source here? What would be the reason that they're bringing this to the table? Try to understand intent. Because I think if I understand and can get some sort of line on intent, then I can kind of start to think about, was this somebody that I should be talking this through with and having that perspective? Or is this something where I should, you know, be doing my own kind of reconnaissance on the back end type situation? And then I would want to go and look through my, you know, the details of whatever they're saying. And do I have anything documented, anything like that? And then I'd like to just try to understand, help others once it comes up, what my perspective is on that or where that's coming from. Maybe that's a little bit more of my kind of, you know, especially when you're in a position like myself, that fortunately that has not come up for me. But if it did, I'd really want to understand like why, where is this coming from first? And that'll help me put together an attack plan to go from there. But I don't know if that's the answer you'd be looking for. Would you hire me?
I'd hire you, Oz. No problem. Every experience I've had with you has been a good one. I think that's enough field validation to make that choice for you. I'm not sure we can afford you, though.
I drink wine on the job every once in a while. I just got to tell you. No, all right, let's take it a little bit of a different direction. You grew up in MSH. Has got an office out in Nashville. It's one of my favorite cities. It's very cold there right now from talking to my team out there. And you were there for 42 years. So like the thing about Nashville is like, it's been on a come up, right? For, I would say, the last 10, 15, 20 years. So much so that now when I go there, you know, you hear people talking about, oh my God, the California migration and all these people that are coming found out about our little secret here in Nashville. But you're an original, you know, original article. You're an original gangster, I guess is the best way to put it. So it's seen as this big up and coming city. You tell me about what it was like 42 years ago or, you know, when you were there. Give me an idea of like what it was like growing up there and how it's changed.
Well, I think you got to stop saying up and coming about Nashville. It's up.
You're right. You're right. It's here. It's arrived.
It's there. When I moved away from Nashville, a pop star from the Netherlands bought my house for cash above asking price the day that it went on the market.
Whoa.
But before that, I mean, Nashville was a place, it was a nice place. I mean, it was a kind of place where you played outside until the streetlights came on. You know what I mean? It wasn't terribly cosmopolitan. It was pretty laid back. I remember one time, though. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's known for the music industry, right?
Yep.
And it's hard for me to get starstruck, though, with that because of growing up in that city. I mean, I got more excited meeting the members of Voivod, my favorite metal band, than I ever did Johnny Cash. But I do remember skipping church one morning, church service after Sunday school, and going up to the Hyatt Regency Hotel to see if we could catch Metallica in the hotel room. And we did. We saw them in the lobby. That was really exciting. I knew every
bars Ulrich like in person.
Short, really, really short. Yeah. I knew everybody. Like I got a telephone pole moved one time because I called a guy that I went to high school with who was responsible for that stuff. You know what I mean?
Sure.
That's like an act of God to get that done. One time we drove a Jeep through Richland Creek, which backs up to Belle Meade, one of the most affluent areas in Nashville. And we came up out of the back of it into a backyard where they were having a graduation party. And the kids just went nuts. It was a lot of fun. But Nashville, it's, you know, today it's just, there's so much traffic. I mean, you need a helicopter to get everywhere you want to go.
Yeah, it's definitely way more populous and there's a different vibe. The food scene has really, really expanded to something that, I don't know if a lot of people know this, but it's one of my favorite food cities from a perspective of like, there is just like these like bistros or these like famous chefs move there and they open up these places that are not necessarily the places that like in Miami are like the five-star ones that you got to go there to see and be seen. but they're just, the food is incredible. The craft cocktail scene is incredible. So every time I go there, I think I probably gain 5 to 10 pounds. And then I work it off at maybe a concert or something like that. But I just think it's a great city. I got to ask you, though, man. Like, you brought up, I mean, listen, I'm a hard rock guy. I'm a classic rock guy. Maybe not, like, at the level you are, because I don't know if I'm metal. Like, I love Metallica, but that's probably right where I stop. It feels like you're a level above that on kind of the hard rock pyramid. But that's not Nashville's vibe. So, like, what, like, was there, like, any story behind that? Or are you counterculture? Or, like, how'd that come up?
Yeah, you know, I think a couple things happened. What I like to tell people is I heard Black Sabbath at the Babysitters when I was, like, 6 years old, and it ruined my life. But I also think, too, like, you know, that was the city was all country music, right? And if you wanted to be cool and do something different, then, like you say, you enter that subculture of something else. You're like, oh, I don't like what everybody else likes. I like this special thing over here. Now they have a word for that. It's called hipster, and I try to avoid that term if I can. But you know, there was a thriving, I mean, there's lots of artists that go to Nashville to record that aren't in country music. There's a rock band out there. It's very, very theatrical. They're called Ghost. And if you look them up, you'll see they wear makeup and masks and things like that. And we ran into them in a place in Nashville and talked to them for a really, really long time and learned the guy's name. Oh, I'm Tobias. Oh, well, I'm Andrew. Well, turns out that he was there recording an album, and he was using a choir in Nashville to record some things on his album. I mean, so there's just, you know, and you see everybody there. It's just a really, you know, eclectic city.
Okay, we're going to come back to it. We love to do our speed round at the end. So there's going to be some music theme, some Nashville theme. So we're going to come back to that in a little bit.
Finding the right talent for your team doesn't have to be a struggle. Meet Aon Hire, the world's first hiring experience management platform designed to transform the way you hire. Powered by AI, Aon Hire takes the hassle out of every step in the process. From smart resume analysis to customized interview questions, it saves you time, money, and effort. Plus, with real-time insights from every interview, you can quickly identify top candidates, reduce turnover, and stay on budget. And forget about note-taking. Aon Hire takes care of that for you. Ready to revolutionize your hiring process? Visit aonhire.com and get started today.
The show's about hiring. I care about hiring deeply. I want to learn, like we talked about at the beginning of the show, from the people who are doing it better and differently. We can talk about this from the lens of either the teams that you've built personally or how you would advise other companies. My question to you is, though, let's start here. Do you have a core hiring philosophy?
Core hiring philosophy. Yeah. Well, like, you mean like hire for attitude, train for skill, that
just
kind of thing?
The things that you've learned over your time, like what works and what doesn't, and you kind of adhere to this or you advise people around it.
Yeah. I think that there's, you know, a whole lot of people that you need to hire to fit your culture. That's what you need to do, because your culture, whether you think you have a culture or you don't have a culture, you have one. It might not be the one you want. And that's a very delicate and also very important thing. So if you hire people that threaten that culture or don't fit with it, you know, that's just, you're shooting yourself in the foot. And, you know, there's a lot of people that may not, I don't know, drink the Kool-Aid or whatever you want to call it. But I mean, and that's okay. It's a choice. Like, you come somewhere and you choose to be where you are. And so to fight against that all the time, I think, is really kind of counterproductive. So you got to watch out for that. And I think the way that you do that is that you expose the people to different levels, different personalities. You know, all those folks can fit nicely in the same organization, in the same culture, but everybody has a different perspective. So if all you do is you talk to the executives, they're going to sell you on what a great place and what a bright future it has. You know, you want to talk to somebody that fights with the, you know, payroll system every day, or somebody who, you know, these time clocks never work, or gosh, our safety equipment's awful. I wish somebody would do something about that. Let them see the whole spectrum, you know, expose them to that. Now, you can't make it a gauntlet. Like, you can't have 7 to 12 steps in your interview process. I mean, it's, you know, whether people say that the market's softening or not, I mean, you got to think about candidate experience all the time. Because from the moment you meet them till the first day that they come, you know, they're making a decision, right, about how prepared you are for them or how welcome they feel or how thoughtful you've been about their arrival or that conversation. And you just want to make a good impression every single day. And, you know, we take that for granted sometimes after people start. When I joined Wineshipping, we had trouble with onboarding. We did. Remember Randy Tucker, the CEO, he goes, just get yourself there, get set up, and then tell me everything that's wrong with that process. I said, okay. Now it's among our top employee engagement dimensions. And we measure that with data. So, you know, just everything is figure outable, as somebody on my team says a lot.
I love that. It's really good stuff. Oh, there's a couple of threads I want to pull in there. Can you think of a time in your career where maybe, you know, somebody went against their better judgment and maybe brought in somebody that had really high experience or aptitude and it wasn't a cultural fit, or maybe you even did it and went against your better judgment, and like what kind of the outcome was there? Like when have you seen it go really bad?
Oh man. You know, I do remember one time a long time ago, we hired a comp and benefits person. This is back when, I don't know, this was 2009, 2010, something like that. We hired somebody who had a lot of experience, and we had a desperate need. We were having trouble finding that person. And it was just strange. I mean, like they did fine in the interview process. And then as soon as they started, it was a lot of things. I guess if I'm not using the name, I can be more specific. But, you know, they were out a lot, you know, from the get-go. The work product wasn't what we thought it was at all. Digging into things, you know, sure enough, turns out that the folks that gave us references were kind of scared to say anything bad because they'd had a, you know, bad experience too. So, and that's so disruptive to the people that work for them, to the plans and things that you entrust them with, to your goals that you've set that they're a part of. It's just, you know, just a bad situation all around. A big ego. So if you can hire somebody who's great, got great experience, great references, all that stuff, they come in and they're great to me. They're great to the CEO. They're great to the chief operating officer, but they got sharp elbows, you know, when you're talking next, you know, peers and people below them. And that's not okay. I mean, that's not what we want. If you're treating me different, I'm dating myself here, but you know, don't be Eddie Haskell.
Eddie Haskell. Whoa, I don't know if I've got an Eddie Haskell reference. I know who that is. I think some of our listeners will. I got to ask this because it kind of stands out to me. And I think this is something that is really tough. And I've seen this a lot in my career. People that lead up well, it's really hard to identify the ones with the sharp elbows that don't do the same going down, right? Because what happens is the people below look at this person as their leader and their manager. And so they're very, very careful about what they say or speaking up, and they probably deal with a lot of abuse, right? Or just keep quiet altogether. But it's hard to know because it's like, well, it seems impossible. This person is so great in the executive meeting. So this person does a great job with their boss. But like, I see this all the time. Like, and it's a little bit manipulative, right? And certainly like being a little bit of a chameleon. And I don't think it's a great thing. Now listen, leading up is important. Knowing how to make your manager look great, knowing how to give the executive team what they want is super important. But you've got to take an even higher bar on the people below you. And in my mind, being a servant leader and taking care of those people, you know, one or the other to me doesn't make sense. You've got to at least blend on both of those to ultimately be successful. You agree with that?
100%. If, you know, I'm fortunate. I got this LinkedIn profile. And if you look on there, folks have been really generous in what they'll write on there about me. And most of those people are people who reported to me. I think that you've also got to create a bunch of channels for people to share that information with you. You know, it's not a natural thing to trust your employer. It's just not. So we do that through relationships. Remember the ISOR thing we talked about? You can do that with anybody in the organization at any level, any team, any situation. It always works. And if you've got a lot of different ways folks can let you know how they're feeling, you can see where that's happening and you can intervene on their behalf.
That's really good advice. I like that. What about a memorable interview experience, either good or bad? It could be one that you were sitting in the interview or maybe one you were doing the interview. But does anything come to mind when I bring that up?
Oh, my God. There's so many of them. One of my favorites is I interviewed somebody who said that they had collective bargaining experience. And, you know, we went through the whole interview and it wasn't going great at the very end. And I don't even know if I should have said this or not, but I said, listen, there's no way in hell you're going to get this job, but I have to ask you something. Tell me about your collective bargaining experience. And the candidate said, yeah, she says, that's where you partner with other companies to get better prices on things like office supplies and things like that. And I was like, thank you very much.
Wow. So that is not what collective bargaining is. I know what collective bargaining is because I follow a lot of sports and I know how important those negotiations are for player rights versus owner rights and all that good stuff. That is not what that is. You already knew they weren't getting the job, but that had to seal the deal for you.
But I told them too, you know, I was like, it's not going to happen, but I'm just so curious here. Right. I mean, you like you said, when we started, a lot of people say, hey, you're not what I expected when I was told I was going to meet the chief HR person. I mean, one time I gave a guy in Mexico City a used car to settle a labor dispute. You know what I mean? So it's just like.
Andrew, I love this. This is good stuff. I love it. Not an out of the box CHRO, but effective. And your people love you. So that matters. What about a favorite question? Do you have a favorite question you like to ask to unlock things?
Yeah, I'll say, what's something that you'd rather be doing than this right now? Sometimes I'll ask people that.
Like in the moment or the job that they do?
In the moment.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And
you can be anywhere you want. What's that?
You ever get nothing? I want to be here with you, Andrew, interviewing.
Yeah, I'm like, yeah, try again. You know, so there's this coaching, you know, strategy that says, hey, Oz, what's on your mind? And you go, well, I'm thinking about this business thing and that business thing and the other business thing. And you go, okay, and what else? And then you go, well, there's this other business thing. And I go, and what else? And by the time we do this a few times, you can't come up with things you think I want to hear. That's when you start talking about what you're really thinking about. And so that's something that I use. I mean, it's a, I think I'm not much of a poet, but I like haikus. And there's a coaching haiku that says, talk less, listen more. Your advice is not as good as you think. And so that's what I try to do. I just try to listen as much as I possibly can. That's how you know somebody will accept a used car to settle a labor dispute.
We got an Eddie Haskell reference. We got a haiku reference. We are apps. We got a ghost death metal band reference. We're breaking barriers in this podcast, my man. I love it. Last one I'll ask you from the hiring side. You talked a lot about candidate experience, and God, I love to hear that. I love to hear that from a senior leader because I just find it to be so important. I can tell by the way that you try to disarm people in the interview. What is the best candidate experience you ever went through in an interview process that showed you what the company was about?
Oh, wow. So, you know, when you work in the kitchen, a lot of times you don't, you know, get to appreciate, you know, the dining room. So I would say that my candid experience, if it's smooth, right? So I've been working in private equity for a long time. And so not only do you meet with other members of the local executive team, but you also meet with, you know, analysts, partners, you know, deal partners, that kind of thing. And when you see that they're all kind of on the same page, that makes me feel so much better. So because when you have, you know, some pretty heavy stakeholders with very divergent opinions about what they're looking for, that creates a very difficult set of conditions for success. And so seeing that they're all aligned in what they're looking for and what they're trying to do, that's what creates a great experience for me. You know, I'm kind of like a cat. You just put food out, you know, and I'm fine. It's I don't need a whole lot of, you know, wining and dining or, you know, gifts or kind of things like that. Just make sure that, you know, if the person before me had food in their desk, that it's gone when I get there. That would be a good thing.
That's good experience. That sounds like you're speaking from experience. Did you have somebody that left some rotten food?
No, I found other things in the desk, which one time I found a bag of oregano.
Oregano, yeah. It's common that people bring oregano to work.
Yeah. And then there's another thing too. If you're reusing computer equipment, like if you're reprovisioning it for people, don't send somebody a laptop with a bunch of dents and stuff in it. I mean, come on, let's make sure that, you know,
give them a good experience. Like make them feel like you're excited to have them there. We at my company have put a lot of work into our onboarding because you know the statistics when it comes to the success of the onboarding and what that means to the tenure of the person. We try to make it a really big deal, both in terms of how we introduce them to the company, to what they walk into when they get here. It should feel exciting. It should feel special. It should feel like, oh, wow, like they're excited to have me here. And I just think so many companies, you know, either through, you know, ignorance or just lack of resources or what, just don't put enough thought into it. So I agree with you, man. I think it's super important. And I think you've given some really good advice in that space. Let's look a little bit day in the life. Are you working on anything right now that you're really excited about?
Oh gosh, a bunch of stuff. Our board meeting's next week, which is the last one that we'll have in 2024. We're building a sales machine, that's obviously important to our business. I've got a couple of things I'm going to do next year that I can't give you details on, but because I have to share the details with my team first, but they're pretty exciting and I think they're going to love it. We're going to replace our human capital management system.
Okay.
Which is exciting, you know, and also kind of challenging. When you're in logistics, you've really got about 8 months a year that you can work on things because you don't change anything at all during peak. Peak is just the Super Bowl for 3-4 months of business. So you've got sort of a limited window to work on things. In the summertime, we don't ship as much wine as we normally do. We do have temperature controlled solutions and they do work. I've seen them. But that's when we do a lot of our projects. Like one time we changed – when we bought the company, it had a lot of what we call warehouse management systems in different locations. They were all different. And we spent one summer and just made them all the same. And that was pretty challenging. But we had to get that done, obviously, before the peak season started.
Do you have a piece of content that you'd recommend for our listeners, whether it be a book or a movie? I want to tell you, if you're building your sales machine, you said this made me think of it. I just read a book called The Machine. About building a sales organization, and it had a lot of great insights in there. So I would definitely check that out if you've heard of it.
Sure. One of them that I love to go back to all the time is if you ever heard Marshall Goldsmith?
Yeah, of course.
Of course you have, right? He wrote a book called What Got You Here Won't Get You There.
It's like, it's a Bible for me because we got to a point in our company where the things that we did to make our initial success were actually the things holding us back from our ability to scale and go to that next level. And so that's a big, and listen, I talked to a lot of entrepreneurs and founders. That is the biggest jump, I think. It's one thing to have an idea and then actually have the guts to go out and start something. Then getting it to somewhere is another big deal, of course, right? That it's something of value. But that next step, man, I've taken it from like, okay, like individually, I was able to build this. But now going forward, it can't be about me individually anymore. My hands have to come off. And the systems have to be what drive us going forward. And that book really gave me a lot of good insights and advice, things that I'm still trying to apply to this day as we grow. So I love that book.
Well, there's 500 guys 5 minutes from here who made $20 million on the Intercoastal that will never make $50 million because they believe what got them there is the right answer. Some of them want to, some of them don't. I've actually met Marshall Goldsmith and spent the whole day with him a couple of times. He's a really, really interesting guy. I got a signed copy of his book back there, which I'm kind of proud of.
That's awesome.
But yeah, it's that reminding me all the time. It's like sometimes, especially when you're thinking about talent, you don't want disruption on your team. You don't want turnover. You don't want, because turnover is a bad thing and all that. But there are a lot of folks, and God bless them, you know, they helped you get where you are. But to do what you need to do next, you're going to have to make a change. And that's not easy. You know, you got to do that with dignity. You got to do that with thoughtfulness. You got to do that with care. You got to, there's just a lot to that. So, I mean, you could keep a full-time job could just be, you know, constantly evaluating and upgrading your talent and repurposing people or helping them exit gracefully or helping them find other things. I mean, that's just part of the game.
Love that. All right, last question before we get to our speed round, our world famous speed round. Some people just fast forward through the whole podcast just to get to the speed round. That's what people are saying. But before we get there, what's some advice you'd give your 20-year-old self that you didn't know then but that you know now?
Oh, gosh. Don't try to be a superhero. Become a servant leader earlier in your career. When you help others and you make them successful, you are successful. You can't see that when you're trying to climb the ladder, but you get to a point really fast where you're like, gosh, I can't be everywhere and do everything. And the more I try to do and the more I try to be, the less I'm good at all of those things. So what I need to do is I really need some help and I need to trust some people.
Good stuff, man. I love that. Nothing to add. No notes. All right, let's jump into it. We are going to speed round. We're going to mix in Nashville. We're going to mix in music. All right, first thing, favorite restaurant in Nashville?
Virago.
Virago, what type of food?
It's like Asian fusion.
Asian fusion.
You know what? I answered that way too fast. Probably Marche in East Nashville.
Marche. Okay, now yeah. I'm writing these down because I'm going to go to them. Marche and Virago. Okay, and you've been recently? They're still open?
Yeah, they're still open.
Done. I'm in. All right, what's your favorite thing? What's your favorite? Like, if you're not drinking wine, you're going to have a...
Oh, scotch. If it was called Scotch Shipping, I'd probably work there for free.
Scotch Shipping. What's your favorite scotch?
Oh, man, there's so many. I like Dalmore and Balvini.
Okay. Love that. Best concert you've ever been to? Bonus points if it was in Nashville.
Oh, yeah. It was in Nashville. It was Iron Maiden at the arena downtown, and our law firm put us up in the box to watch it. It was funny. Every year they'd get a whole bunch of tickets to the suites there, and the person who was in charge of that would put all the metal shows aside and just make sure I didn't want them before she gave them to somebody else.
See, it's because you know everybody there. You're getting phone polls, Moo. You can definitely get great metal concert tickets.
Down in South Florida, I'm just another jerk in line everywhere. You know what I mean?
The funny thing is? I'll tell you this. I'm a big rock and roll guy. I grew up loving rock and roll. I was a kid of the 90s, so like I love grunge. I love all of that. And I grew up in Southern California, lived in Arizona. Lot of rock concerts. Then I moved to South Florida, and I don't know if they just don't make it down here or what the deal is, but like all of a sudden I found myself starting to listen to more house music, techno music, and rap and all these different things. But I miss good old fashioned rock and roll, and there's not a lot of it being put out nowadays either.
Fun fact, Tampa, Florida is the death metal capital of the United States.
All right, you and I are going to a death metal concert in Tampa. We're going to get to an hour and a half. My only ask is you drive us home.
Don't worry.
Who is the musician who you most let you down when you met them?
Oh, gosh. Garth Brooks.
Okay. Can we tell why?
He's a jerk.
Was he? Just rude and short or what?
Yeah. I mean, I've met a bunch of them in Nashville. And like I just didn't feel like he was a kind person. I hate to say that, like, you know, in a public forum about anybody, but you asked a question.
Yeah. And I don't think Garth listens. I don't know. Maybe he does, maybe he doesn't. But probably not. We're probably okay. All right. Last one. If you're listening to a country singer, you're listening to?
Oh, Johnny Cash.
Okay.
Or Willie Nelson. That old school country is something else. I met Johnny Cash, and I it was a Saturday night, and Sunday was at my grandmother's house. And I said to her, Gammy. I just called my grandmother Gammy. I said, Gammy, guess who I met last night? And she said, who? And I said, Johnny Cash. And my Gammy, who had never said a bad thing about anybody that I'd ever heard in my life, she says, I hope he didn't have that nasty June Carter with him. So I went outside and asked my grandpa, and I was like, hey, what was that about? And my grandfather looks at me and he goes, I don't want to talk about it, son. To this day, I don't know, but there was something.
June Carter, was that his wife or?
June Carter was his second wife.
Second wife. Oh, so Gammy and June Carter must have had some sort of. And if Grandpa didn't want to talk about it, maybe it involved Johnny Cash.
Maybe, you know, okay. Like I don't know.
All right, we'll
I was
never
too
know.
Scared. Well, yeah, to man. Ask anything else.
I want to find out. I got to know now. How am I going to be able to sleep? Andrew, listen. This has been great. I got to tell you what, man, you're different. Listen, do you fit the archetype of every CHRO I've ever met? Definitely not. And I think that is a great thing. I love what you brought to the table, though. There's so many good things that you shared with us. You are definitely the type of guy that I would want to get a beer with. And if people don't agree with that, then I don't know if I want to get a beer with you. I really appreciate you coming on, man. And we're going to get some scotch together. You're just down the road from me down here in South Florida. So I can't wait to get together in person, man. Really appreciate you spending some time with me.
Thanks, Oz. It's been a pleasure. It always is.